Thanks so much for joining us. Welcome into another edition of Ask the Experts. I'm Dave Callender, and my guest this hour, it's going to be an interesting one. My guest is Dr. Patrick Quaid, a doctor of optometry with a PhD in the area of vision science. He's also got a focused interest in the area of rehabilitative vision therapy. He hails originally from Ireland, trained as an eye doctor in the UK, working at Moorsfield Eye Hospital in London, before coming over to Canada to pursue the PhD that he has in vision science. Now, specifically, he studied how the brain deals with illusions and essentially how the brain can be tricked. They've got a couple of documentaries on Netflix I've watched recently, and I find it absolutely fascinating. The point is that by understanding how illusions work, he's come to some interesting conclusions about reading-based learning difficulties and how the visual brain can be affected in concussion. Dr. Quaid's current research and clinical work focuses on rehabilitative strategies in the areas of reading-based learning difficulties in children and induced vision issues in concussion. He is the only appointed consultant optometrist at the University of Toronto Sports Medicine Clinic and is also an adjunct professor at the University of Waterloo, in addition to being the chief optometrist at the Guelph Vision Therapy Center. So welcome to the show, Dr. Quaid. Wow, that is a mouthful. How do you keep all that in line?
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for helping us to raise awareness with respect to this very important topic. Thank you also for saying my PhD was in illusions. It sounds a lot cooler than saying my PhD was in psychophysics, which sounds dead boring.
I don't know about that. Psychophysics sounds very science fiction. Either way, it's fascinating. And I'm sure that our listeners would like to know a little bit more about you and how you got into this field. Now, I gather that as a child, you yourself had some major issues with your vision following a car accident. Now, absolutely fascinating story to share with our listeners, and it may also help explain a little bit about rehabilitative vision therapy.
Of course. I was involved in a car accident when I was about 8. I was hit by a car actually in front of my aunt's house while I was playing with my buddies. And the management, quite frankly, of concussion back then in those days was dismal, and to some extent still is. Basically, if you're breathing, you were fine. I had a loss of consciousness for about 5 minutes, and all medical tests were fine. And for 24 hours or so, I felt okay, but the next day or two, I started to feel I had a lot of issues. I started having trouble reading, headaches were coming on, and I was very sensitive to light. I also concurrently started, interestingly, to develop a speech impediment, or a stammer, which was vicious, actually. It lasted for about a year. And was certainly correlated to the event because it started within a day or two of the event. The interesting thing, though, is when I was reading, I had to turn my head to one side to read as I was basically trying to use my nose to block one eye. So, or I just closed one eye when I read because my tracking was a big issue for sure. Even with the adaptations, I still had issues tracking and my academics fell a lot. So it took about 12 to 18 months for somebody to realize I was actually seeing double. So I was seeing two things out to about maybe a meter. The kicker was I was seeing 20/20 the whole time. In fact, my parents took me to three eye doctors who said my eyes were fine. And I started to wonder if I would get through high school. Of course, I found it very odd that I was being told my eyes were fine, even though I was having all these symptoms. And I really felt like my eyes were dancing on the page when I was reading. My eyes just felt like they were moving almost involuntarily. Of course, with your eyes like that, you don't really want to read. And you have a hard time processing what you're reading. I think about the 9-month mark, I started to just get the impression that maybe it was me. And in fact, something very interesting, my mother was told in front of me actually twice that I may not get through high school, which was a very interesting experience.
Oh, well, that's nice. I'm glad they said that directly in front of you. And I do want to point out now that if you were a child now and went through this car accident, you would be checked for concussion like right off the bat. It's not the same as it was back then.
Well, I think some of the aspects are similar, but I think even now we know MRIs are not very useful in concussion. They don't really show a problem a lot of the time. Really, now we're looking for soft neurological signs is kind of what they call it. So it's like if you have a bruise on your hand, if you do an MRI on your hand is going to look normal. It doesn't mean it's not injured.
Mm-hmm.
And concussion is really brain bruising. It involves the neck too, but it's really the brain. So the issue is you have to look at the function of the patient, and really the best way to get to the brain is through vision, because 40% of the brain is actually visual machinery, which is a stat that not a lot of people are very aware of.
So obviously, well, I'm hoping you got treatment eventually.
Yeah, I managed to find somebody to help me with my speech issue, so I do have a healthy respect for speech and language pathology, because that was actually my first point of contact. And then thankfully, that person in Ireland at the time, I actually also knew an optometrist who did a very basic form of rehabilitative VT back then. I mean, back in Ireland then, and still to some extent, VT is not very well developed. It took about 8 or 9 months of weekly sessions to get me back to where I should be. I was on the honor roll again within a year. I more or less got vision therapy and speech pathology done in the same building, which was a neat concept, which is something actually we've tried to replicate in Guelph, which actually works well. I still believe that although phonetic training is critical in reading, vision issues are just as critical, if not more so. VT is also much more developed in North America compared to in Ireland or in Europe in general. I mean, groups such as COVD, which is the College of Optometrists and Vision Development, and OEP, which is the Optometric Extension Program, have actually helped very much raise awareness in this issue. And I've actually been around for a very long time. Like, we're talking 1930s, so they're certainly not new. You know, the fact that it took me 18 months to get back to where I should be from a therapy standpoint was extremely frustrating. And actually, my older brother, to give him the credit, actually read to me for about 18 months during that time period. Because I started to realize if I avoided my vision, I did fine. So if somebody read to me, I could understand everything. But if I read it myself, I would have to go over the text 2 or 3 times. Or if I read something, I couldn't remember what I read. So I have to give him a lot of credit for sure. And I basically thrived when I avoided my visual system. So guess where the issue was?
Mm-hmm. I just want to mention that if folks want to get some more information as they listen to the show today, you can go online and find out more about the Guelph Vision Therapy Center at gvtc.ca. Now, do you think these visual problems are an issue in mainstream academics now?
Let me put it this way. About 1 in 10 kids in the Ontario School Board, we actually published a paper in a medical journal in 2013 in Graves Archives of Clinical and Experimental Ophthalmology. And what we found was about 1 in 10 kids in our school boards has an IEP in place. And what an IEP is an individualized educational plan, which is basically the school saying, you know, the child's having difficulty reading and we'll put accommodations in place to help the kid learn better. And typically these accommodations involve, you know, speech to text or text to talk. So typically a lot of these accommodations are designed to avoid the visual system. If you look at most of the IEP reports for the schools for these kids, they're actually designed to avoid the visual system. And about 84%, these are stats from the Learning Disability Association of Canada, about 84% of these cases are primarily due to issues with reading and written output, which, you know, if you close your eyes, those things don't really happen, do they?
No. Not at all.
And I think it's important as well to realize that these are, again, stats from the Learning Disability Association of Canada. The average kid with an IEP in place at the end of high school to retirement will earn about $1.98 million less in income over their lifetime. And the educational system, the healthcare system, will incur about $450,000 in increased costs compared to a kid without an IEP. And by the way, 60% of those costs are coming from the parents. So that's like having a second mortgage in addition to your kid earning $2 million less over their lifetime. So it's a big issue. It should be taken very seriously. And you know, half joking, half serious, really, the government should be very interested in this, because if you have individuals who are earning $2 million less over their lifetime, you would think that the CRA would be interested in that.
Oh, absolutely.
So I mean, keep in mind, in the 70s and 80s, when I was young, the big issue was access to information. So for example, maybe I sound old saying this, but it was a big deal when my dad came home and brought home the Encyclopedia Britannica. It was a big deal for us. You know, it was, yay, we got access to information. Whereas nowadays, of course, everyone's got Google, everyone's got their cell phones. So access to information is not the barrier. Really, the barrier is the ability to process this information quickly and effortlessly and be able to disseminate what's important and what's not. So the currency really now is the ability to read quickly and process quickly. And I like to use the term academic inflation. I've got a lot of colleagues who, you know, will say 50 years ago, if you got a degree, you could write your ticket. You had a job, no problem. Now, I have colleagues getting PhDs who are looking for work. So the reality is the requirement from an academic standpoint in order to have gainful employment in this day and age is a lot more heavily dependent on somebody being able to process information quickly. 70 to 80% of what a kid does in a classroom is visually based.
My guest today on the show, we're talking with Dr. Patrick Quay, Doctor of Optometry and PhD in the area of vision science. If you'd like to get more information, as we mentioned, you can fire up your web browser and go online to gvtc.ca. And if you'd like to call the Guelph Vision Therapy Center, the phone number is 519-265-8895. Stick around. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with more of Ask the Experts here. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us. My guest, Dr. Patrick Quay, Doctor of Optometry and PhD in the area of vision science with the Guelph Vision Therapy Center, online at gvtc.ca. Now, I'm hoping you can go into a little bit more detail as to how vision is related to reading and spelling. It seems like a simple question. It's like if you don't have vision, you can't read. But how does it all fit together?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think you can be a bad reader and see 20/20 and a good reader and see 20/20. This is kind of the myth of reading. And a lot of doctors actually think that, you know, your vision is not very predictive of how you read. Oddly enough, I've actually heard that in lectures. And the interesting thing is, if we're talking about visual acuity, so if you're talking about what you see on the eye chart at the doctor's office, which we read at 20 feet, that actually has very little bearing on your ability to read. What does have bearing on your ability to read is your eye teaming skills, is whether your eyes team together. There's about 15 to 20 other visual skills that you have to have. For example, there's some people who can cross their eyes, some people can't. The interesting thing about that is if you can cross your eyes voluntarily, it probably means you have a higher degree of control over your visual system. And I know we're in the radio studio right now, but I can look at you and I can make you double. I can keep you double. I can look at one of your images and I can move one eye in and I can bring you back together, look at the other image and move the other eye in. So the reality is we can control the system if we know how to access it.
Mm-hmm.
So realistically, it's the eye teaming skills that are very important. And what they ultimately lead to, none of us are born with binocular vision. When we're born, our eyes actually don't team together. They don't start to come together till about 3 to 4 months. So the interesting thing is visual skills are learned. They're not innate. So there's a lot of things that can knock them out of track going through your early years, for example, or a concussion. Ultimately, what these oculomotor skills lead to, the crowning jewel of the visual system, in my opinion, is something called visual memory. Obviously, depth perception is important as well. We'll get to that in a bit. But visual memory as it relates to spelling is really, really key. So for people who are listening, if you obviously don't do this if you're driving, but if you are, for a moment, I want you to in your mind, spell the word future. So think about how you'd spell that word. Most of us would go, okay, I got it, F-U-T-U-R-E. Now, if I challenge you to spell that word going backwards, what's the first thing that you do?
I'm picturing the word in my mind,
yeah.
And then I'm going E R U T U F.
Okay, so but were you picturing the word?
Yes.
Right, so that's visual memory. Now, a lot of people do not have visual memory. So we have people at school, and you say, oh, you have a photographic memory. What they have is visual memory. So if I read something, it's my ability to be able to recall what I've read. Now put yourself in grade one or grade two. When you're still learning to read, you're not reading to learn yet. You're learning to read, and a teacher shows you a word for the first time. You've never seen it before,
mm-hmm.
And then an hour later, the teacher says, hey, little Johnny, can you spell that word again for me? The difficulty for you spelling future going backwards is how that feels to that child. So if that child looks up and nothing appears, they're kind of in trouble,
mm-hmm.
Which means now their only option is to spell the word how it sounds. So these will be the kids who will be in grade three or grade four and still spelling phonetically. So they're still spelling future as, future, future, F-U-C-H-E-R. They'll guess at it. So these kids who have spelling issues, basically good spellers have good visual memory, and visual memory is a crowning jewel of a properly working eye teaming system. Visual memory doesn't evolve unless you have eye teaming working together. And in fact, we see the same thing not just in developmental cases, but we see the same thing in concussion patients. A lot of concussion patients come to us and say, yeah, it's not just the reading. I'm coming home, I put my keys somewhere, and I go and make a cup of tea, and I can't remember where I put my keys. Their general short-term memory is pooched. So when most of us think about finding something that we've lost, we typically try to go through it in our head, what was I doing in the last 5 or 10 minutes? So that, again, is a different type of visual memory. And actually, Dr. Early, Michael Early, who's at Ohio State, did some really cool research using fMRI and something called DTI, or diffuse tensor imaging, where basically he could look at what parts of the brain lit up in what sequence while you're reading. Really cool stuff. And what Mike showed was when you read, the first part of your brain, if you're a good reader, the first part of your brain to light up is obviously your visual cortex. There's an area in the brain called VWFA, or Visual Word Form Association. If you're a good reader, the visual cortex lights up first, then your frontal cortex lights up. So in other words, I see the word, I recognize it, I can match it to something I've seen before. If you're a poor reader, the visual cortex still lights up first, but then the auditory cortex lights up, then the frontal cortex. So what that means is, if I'm a poor reader, I look at the word, I don't recognize it, I have to sound it out in my head in order to figure out what the word is. So obviously, if I don't have good visual memory, essentially I'm destined to probably not be a great reader. So reverse engineering the system, if the ocular motor system's in trouble, what you want to do first is work on the ocular motor system, and then after that you have to work on the visual memory skills to build it up. And typically you can get people to be much stronger from a reading standpoint if you do that.
That really is fascinating. I never thought of it that way, but you're right. When I think, again, back to the word you used as an example, future, when I see that on a page anymore, I am not sounding that out in my head. My brain automatically goes, that's word future, on to the next word.
Yep.
So just, I never even given that any thought at all. Now, maybe you could give our listeners an idea of how vision in general is involved in reading and attention ability overall.
Well, attention's a big one. I mean, keep in mind, again, we said that over 40% of the human brain, of human brain machinery, is primarily geared for vision. And that's a really stunning statistic. And, you know, for the science buffs out there, it's a Fellman and Van Essen 1991 paper. But it's basically a neuroanatomy paper where they basically injected tracers into the brain and figured out directly 40% of the brain is visual. That's actually more than any other sense. Therefore, vision plays an obvious role in learning. In a classroom, 70 to 80% of what you do in a classroom heavily depends on proper functioning vision. I mean, just think of a couple of things. I'm copying stuff down from the board to the page. I have to move my eyes out and in. If I'm reading, my eyes are converged, they're pulled inwards, and I have to move my eyes from side to side whilst my eyes are pulled in. I mean, there's a huge demand on the visual system. And again, 20/20 is really, the obvious thing about 20/20 is we don't read at 20 feet. We read at 16 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing something up close. So you really have to probe the visual system up close. One example or a skill would be convergence. We talked about that already. Pulling the eyes inwards properly without seeing double. Inability to do this, actually, which is called convergence insufficiency, or CI for short. If a child has trouble pulling their eyes inwards, it's going to cause trouble with tracking, with reading. Headaches may occur. They may also complain of intermittently seeing double when they're fatigued. So it may not be there all the time. So when you ask a kid, do you see double? They immediately think that you mean all the time. And they'll typically say no. But if you say to the kid, well, do you see double, even if it's towards the end of the day when you're reading, do things drift in and out on you? You might get a lot of different responses from your patients. A lot of them will say, actually, yeah, that does happen. Or for some odd reason, I feel more comfortable when I close one eye. So it's really not that hard to understand that if something's not comfortable for a child to do, children are wonderfully logical. I love dealing with kids. There's no hidden filter. They'll just, if you ask them a question, they'll give you a straight answer. And how many kids have said to me in my clinic that when we ask them, do you see double? And they say, oh, yeah. And they'll even describe how it goes double. They say, yeah, it's kind of off at an angle and goes up to one side. And mom or dad are sitting in the exam room and their jaw's on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say to the kid, to their own kid, they'll say, well, why didn't you mention it? And they'll say, well, you never asked. And, you know, kids are wonderfully logical. So if you look in the literature, actually talking about attention, which really is a very important topic, 5 out of the 9 DSM criteria for the diagnosis of attention deficit disorder overlap with the symptoms of CI. Now, CI is one of maybe 15 to 20 types of binocular vision dysfunction out there. So it's not really rocket science to sit back and go, well, wait a minute, if a kid has trouble pulling their eyes inwards and it's uncomfortable for them to do it, they're probably not going to want to read for very long, and they're probably not going to attend for as long as they should. So all the teacher is going to see, or the parent will see, is a kid who just doesn't want to sit down and attend and hunker down and do their work. And they'll often be told, try harder, or, you know, they're not reaching their maximum potential. You'll hear all these phrases from a school standpoint, but you really have to look at how the child is behaving when they're engaged in visual work.
My guest today on the show, Dr. Patrick Quaid, Doctor of Optometry and PhD in the area of vision science. Just quickly going back to what we were just talking about, you know, how logical kids are, and you really struck me when you said you never asked. Do these children just take for granted that the way they're seeing, they think everyone has this double vision thing going on, so they don't mention it?
Yeah, it's really quite stunning that we have had kids sit in our chair and say, and kind of look at us when we say, do you see double, or do things come in and out of focus? And they'll look at you and go, well, yeah, almost with the body language of, well, don't you see that? So they're really stunned when they realize actually that's not normal, because to them it's normal. They've seen that way probably for most of their life, so they don't know anything else. It's like trying to say somebody who has a color deficiency, you know, well, obviously this is the color red. Well, if that person's never seen that hue or that saturation before, it's not within, their brain has never recognized that as normal. So it's really quite fascinating when speaking of illusions in the brain. I mean, this is basically the brain tricking itself into thinking that abnormal is normal.
Joining me is Dr. Patrick Quaid. Dr. Quaid is a doctor of optometry and has a PhD in the area of vision science. He's with the Guelph Vision Therapy Center. And if you'd like to follow along and learn more as you listen to the show today, just fire up your web browser and go to gvtc.ca. You can also call the Guelph Vision Therapy Center at 519-265-8895. Now, obviously, we've been talking today about the fact that you're involved with vision therapy. Maybe you can just tell us a bit more about how you actually do vision therapy, what's involved.
Sure. Vision therapy essentially trains the brain to use the eyes. People think you're doing therapy on the eyes, and yes, you are. But really what you're essentially trying to do is you're trying to teach the brain to control the visual system. So you really want to get to the boss, which is essentially the brain. So similar that if you had surgery on your leg with an orthopedic surgeon, they'd send you to see a physiotherapist. Essentially, we're kind of doing the same thing from a visual standpoint. You know, this is usually done through a sequence of prescribed visual exercises using lenses and prisms when appropriate. So we do have tools that we use, which are individually designed based on the diagnosis and the workup of the patient. The ultimate goal, however, is to get the patient to be able to control the system without undue strain. So basically, we want to make them independent of us and not dependent on us.
All right. So is there something you could share with us to illustrate the sort of things you do in rehabilitative vision therapy?
Sure. I think the easiest one to explain is something that you know, internally we call FISDIP, which is physiological diplopia. It's a lot easier to say FISDIP. And what FISDIP basically, so first of all, for you, those of you who are listening in a car, do not do this in the car while you're driving. You can do this at home. But we use this technique in vision therapy to show the patient that, in fact, we see double all the time, but our brain learns to ignore it consciously. So let me do this with you here in the studio and see if the listeners can follow along. So what I want you to do is hold your index finger in front of you, so
okay.
Pointing at the ceiling.
All right, here we go.
Now, so you're looking at me.
I am.
And what I would like you to do is, while you're looking at me, maybe move your finger a little bit over this side there. So you want to have the finger right in front of your nose. Now, as you're looking at me, how many fingers do you notice as you're looking at me?
Well, I'm having trouble. I'm looking at you, but now I want to look at my finger. Yeah. But while I'm looking at you, I do not see one finger.
How many fingers do you see?
I'm seeing two, and then when my eyes refocus, it goes back to one. And
okay, but keep looking at me, and maybe move a little bit to your left. There you go, right there. So as you're looking at me, you see two fingers, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, so look at your finger now. And uh-huh. How many of me do you see while you're looking at your finger?
Two.
Isn't that weird?
So, that is weird.
So now, and what's interesting is your finger is also not directly in front of your nose. You keep drifting towards your right eye. So that tells me you're probably right eye dominant. You don't really like processing through your left eye. So
bingo. that's remarkable. No, I am. I've always been right eye dominant.
Yeah, and I can see it because, you know, your visual midline should be between your eyes. So basically, for those of you at home, when you're looking far away, so this is the issue of divided attention. This is actually the link to ADHD. When you said, I'm looking far away, I have my finger in front of me, so it's right in front of my nose, pointing up to the ceiling. I'm looking at an object far away, and I see two of my fingers, so I can look in the distance and simultaneously be able to notice that I have two fingers up close. And then I look at my finger, and I notice that I see two of everything in the background. So what you're doing there is you're dividing your visual attention. I'm looking somewhere, but I'm able to pay attention to somewhere else at the same time. So in the auditory domain, so us here on the radio, a similar concept would be you're at work, you're talking to somebody, but one of your work colleagues off to your side is talking about you, and you don't want the person you're talking to realize that you're not listening. So you can pretend you're listening to them, but really you're listening to their colleague who's talking about you.
Mm-hmm.
So we're dividing our attention auditorily. This is really the equivalent in the visual domain. And we do find kids who have attention deficit problems have a really hard time doing that exercise. And also, if how you can use that as a therapy technique is you can look at your finger and realize everything in the background's double, as I move that finger towards my nose, everything in the background that's double gets further apart or should get further apart. If you only see one image, it means your brain has essentially turned off the image to one eye.
Ah.
So that's where it ties back to illusions where, we see double all the time, but actually we don't notice that we see double all the time. Why not? Well, the brain only consciously processes what we're looking at. Everything around what we're looking at may be double and or blurred, but essentially the brainstem, the primitive brain, is still processing that stuff. So that's how we know where we are. If we're walking around a grocery store or a mall, that's how we don't bump into people. Because as I'm looking straight ahead, there's motion in my periphery, in my side vision. So I'm able to automatically essentially calculate where those objects are relative to me. So I know how to adjust my walking pattern so I don't bump into somebody. So if that whole system gets messed up, it can create a whole bunch of problems.
Okay. That really is fascinating, and I'm still incredibly impressed that you knew I was right eye dominant just because my finger was drifting. But yeah, I wear, for folks who've never seen me before, I wear glasses that are essentially like Coke bottles. I have the worst vision of anyone I've ever met, so there you go. Now, you're talking about this, but this is why eye teaming, I guess, gets affected in developmental issues, concussion. Yes, the link to concussion also makes sense, of course, as over 40% of the brain is visual, as you mentioned. Concussion is the essence of traumatic brain injury, correct? Can you enlighten us more on the visual issues that can arise with a concussion?
Sure. Given, as you mentioned, given the proportion of the brain that's primarily visually based, visual issues in concussion are really not a shock. Concussion patients are often very frustrated, as these visual issues are not only overlooked in acute post-concussion care, of course, because they see 20/20, they can see the eye chart okay. Their symptoms are actually often dismissed as psychosomatic. So in other words, well, we can't really find a cause, therefore it must just be in your head, and pat on the back and just rest for a couple of more weeks and you'll be fine. Thankfully, this mentality is changing a little bit, partly actually due to some really good research that was actually done in Ontario. It was published in the research journal Brain Injury, which is a pretty high-level journal, and there was a group of neuropsychologists in Hamilton General. So a shout out to Dr. Aisha Unsal in Hamilton General. So a really good group of neuropsychs who put together a consensus document, which is basically a guideline document for all healthcare professionals on how to manage concussion patients who are not getting better. And actually in that guideline document, they actually specifically mentioned rehabilitative vision therapy. And they basically said any patient who has visual symptoms that is not resolving after a certain period of time, that they need to have a workup from a vision therapy assessment standpoint. So if the eye teaming and tracking is assessed in detail, you often find issues in these patients. And if you just listen to their symptoms, they will complain of eye tracking problems. They will complain of reading. I can't tolerate being in front of a computer screen. I can't go back to work. I have a headache. I'm having trouble in malls. So a lot of these patients will say, if I go into a mall or a grocery store after a concussion, all that motion around me just drives me bonkers. I can't handle it. It almost feels like it's overwhelming for my brain to cope with all that motion. So if you think about the conversation that we just had, that ties into my ability to process motion around me as I'm moving. Mm-hmm. And if you think about when you're in a vehicle or when you're driving, I mean, the amount of peripheral motion. Well, that's how you detect a car coming from the side. That's how you know to change lanes safely. I mean, we don't necessarily look all the time. I may be looking straight ahead, but I can tell that there's a vehicle coming up on my side without having to look at the vehicle. So a lot of that stuff we take for granted because it's automatic. It happens without us thinking. So imagine if you woke up in the morning and you had to think to breathe. You know, what would happen to your cognitive function? You can still breathe, but you had to think to do it. Well, every thought you have, it would be laborious because now something that should be automatic is not automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I always use the analogy of a computer. There's hardware and software, right? I mean, you can have great hardware, but if the software is pooched, everything's going to be slow. And that's essentially what we mean by short-term memory, visual memory, peripheral awareness. You know, keep in mind that concussion is fairly common. If you look in the literature, it's about 500 people in every 100,000. Now, I think that's a dramatic underestimation. That doesn't sound like a lot, but even and I think a lot of these concussions are not reported. A lot of people don't even realize they've had one. They may not go to eMERGE. They may not go for any sort of healthcare check afterwards. It's getting better. A lot of athletic teams are doing baseline testing now, which is good. But the reality is 15% of people who have concussions are still significantly symptomatic 12 months plus post-injury. So a lot of these patients are having symptoms. you know, and it's also worth noting that concussion patients as a whole, and this is something I've started to ask more in my clinic. I've had a couple of cases that have taught me some lessons. Concussion patients, and this is actually research from the Canadian Medical Journal this year or last year. I can't remember exactly the year. But concussion patients are 2 to 3 times higher risk for suicide compared to the general population. Now, this is a pretty serious conversation that we often bring up with the patient at the initial consult to make sure there's nothing going on. And really, it doesn't. It actually makes sense when you think about it, because a lot of these patients do not, it's not like they're walking around with a cast around their leg. A lot of my concussion patients have said, you know, it feels like I have a hidden injury. Nobody really realizes that I'm having trouble. I have a headache 24/7. I'm light sensitive. I can't go outside my house. If I socialize or go to a mall, I have a headache within a couple of minutes. So a lot of these patients will have issues socializing. They'll have issues doing a lot of things that they did prior to the concussion is just not possible. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these patients will come to us. They may not volunteer that information, but I'm amazed how many times when I ask about suicidal tendencies, how many of these concussion patients volunteer and go, oh yeah, as if it's nonchalant, as if it's like, well, yeah, I've thought about that a lot actually.
Wow.
So we typically have to get a neuropsych involved fairly early in those cases and make sure that these patients are getting some help. But if you can't engage in life and you can't engage in gainful employment, you can't work, you're staying at home. I mean, how many of us would stay at home and after a week or two of saying, yeah, this is fun, after a week or two, how many of us would just go out of our minds doing that? I mean, if you cannot go to work and you can't engage in society, to be quite frank, it's not going to be long before your depression indexes go up. And this is all validated in the research. So part of the strength of our clinic in Guelph is we have a multidisciplinary team. You know, we have neuropsychology, we have physiotherapy, audiology. There's a wonderful doc, so this is a shout out to Dr. Comer in Burlington, who does hormone work in concussion, where a lot of males have significant drops in testosterone, a lot of females in their early 30s go into menopause very early. I mean, why? Because the pituitary gland is in the head. It's the master hormone gland. So if you have a concussion or a vibration effect, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that can go way out of whack. So it takes a village to fix these patients. But I think it's a challenging area, but I think vision plays a key role.
Well, maybe you could tell us, whether it's developmentally based or concussion-induced, why exactly these folks have tracking issues when reading, for example?
Well, I mean, at the present time, we feel like we understand the tracking issues. Probably the best thing to do here is to use an analogy. So when we're driving a car, for example, all's good with the vehicle and your radio's on. You're listening to the radio, you're cruising along. Next thing you know, and the steering's working properly, everything's cool. Next thing you know, your steering column starts to go funny because your wheels are out of alignment, right? So you have to work to control the car. You can still control it. What's the first thing that you do to the radio?
Turn it down.
Right. So you're going to decrease the auditory component. So if we look at this, so the reason is you turn off the radio. Why? Because you need to attend more to the task at hand as it's no longer automatic. So just like the steering column, if your eyes go out of alignment, you will likely, of course, have issues tracking and keeping your place on the page and processing what you're reading. But you'll also likely have more issues processing concurrent auditory information. So, for example, if I'm a kid and I'm in a classroom, and I'm copying something down from the board and the teacher is talking to me at the same time, if I have a visual issue, chances are I'm not going to be attending to the teacher from an auditory standpoint, because basically I'm working my rear off just to keep up copying stuff down from the board. Mm-hmm. So the reality is the teacher may then think that the kid's not attentive or they're not paying attention, they're not listening to me. When in reality, the kid is just trying to keep up with doing the visual task. So I think the eye teaming issue is very analogous to the steering column in your car. If the machinery, because remember, the brain ultimately controls the eyes. So if I have a developmental or a concussion-based problem and I don't know how to control my eyes, I don't know how to team them together properly, just like I said earlier, if you had to think to breathe, it's going to affect everything you do. If you have to think to control your eyes, it should be an automatic process. So if that's not automatic, you're going to have some problems. And these issues tend to come up, speaking of school, these issues tend to come up more so in grade 2 or 3. It's interesting because SK, JK, grade 1, the child's still learning to read. They're not reading to learn yet. So they're still learning spelling, they're learning alphabet, they're learning all that stuff. So what typically happens is the kid, even if they have the problem, they look okay in the earlier grades. But as you go to the higher grades, what ends up happening is usually around grade 3 is when we find it is essentially the level, and nothing's changed. All that's changed is that the academic level, the demand has gotten high enough that now the issue is showing. So what we find is a lot of these kids can actually picked up, they can be picked up with some very very basic testing in even grade one. You can just test their convergence. How well can I move my eyes towards my nose? Obviously, getting a routine eye exam is a very good first start, but there's more detailed testing after that that needs to be done. But essentially, the higher grades, the demand on the visual system is high enough for the issues to come to the surface.
My guest is Dr. Patrick Quay, doctor of optometry and PhD in the area of vision science. He's here today with the Guelph Vision Therapy Center. You can find out more online at gvtc.ca, and you can call them at 519-265-8895. We'll be back with more of Ask the Experts. Welcome back to the show, and thanks for joining us. My guest is Dr. Patrick Quaid, who is a doctor of optometry and has a PhD in the area of vision science. He's here today with the Guelph Vision Therapy Center, which you can find out more at gvtc.ca. Now, off the air before we started our show today, you were showing me a little video of an example of how you test people in your lab. It's a special set of goggles for tracking eye movement. What was going on there?
Well, it's something called a visograph. So we basically put the goggle on the kid. Looks like a pair of swim goggles, obviously a lot more complex than that. But there's four infrared cameras mounted on the inside. So when you're reading, the goggle can actually track where your eyes are on the page when you're reading. And after you've done the recording, you can actually replay the movie file and look and see in real time what your kid or what you are reading on the page, in addition to getting some really cool stats.
Now, so do you think the people who've got a developmental issue in their birth history, if they have a concussion, are they at higher risk of a poor recovery compared to someone who doesn't have this birth history?
Well, I think that's a great question. We think so. The research is still emerging in this area. In fact, at the University of Toronto Sports Medicine Clinic, where I serve as a consultant optometrist, we just completed a study. We've submitted it to Brain Injury, and we're very hopeful that it will be published. But we baseline tested 250 varsity athletes, equal proportion of male and female. And we found that depending on what you looked for, there's about 15 different types of binocular vision problems or trouble teaming the eyes together. Anywhere from 5 to 25% of these patients had trouble with their eye teaming at baseline. And some people might say, well, that's odd. Athletes should be better, shouldn't they, because they play sports? Well, yes, but they're also at higher risk of having concussions. And I would say they're also a lot more likely to not report them. Because if I have a concussion, I'm not playing very well. I don't want to let my teammates down, because then I may not be at as high a level as they think I am, and therefore I don't get on the team. Mm-hmm. So I think the short answer is yes. I think if you were born preemie, low birth weight, all those things have been shown in the literature to be a risk factor. If you have those risk factors and then you subsequently have an injury, you have a concussion, which we know induces binocular vision issues or eye teaming issues, it stands to reason that the recovery should be poorer in those people. Because really the holy grail in concussion right now is how can you have two patients of the same age, same gender, same sport, they have a similar injury. Person A is back up and running within a month. Person B is still out a year later. And I think the obvious answer is, well, you got to look at the pre-existing history. What were they prior to the concussion?
Now, I also note here that at your Guelph clinic, which again, people can find out more about at gvtc.ca, you don't sell any product related to eyewear, which, well, frankly, that's a little odd for an optometrist, isn't it? Well, why is it you deal that way?
Well, obviously the eyewear and glasses and contact lenses, that's the traditional area of optometry. Certainly, we've opted not to deal with the eyewear component. This is not to say optometrists shouldn't sell eyewear. Of course, they should. This is the realm of that area, in addition to opticians, of course. We have simply made this decision in order to maintain good relationship with the routine eye care doctors. So basically, we don't want to interfere with the routine eye care. We don't want to interfere with the general care of these patients. We want to act as a service to regular optometry. If I have a patient under my care who has an eye teaming issue, and I'm not sure what to do with it, I need a resource that I can send to that's able to take care of that problem. So our job is to basically treat the issue, get any allied healthcare professionals involved who need to be involved, and get that patient back to the routine eye doc so they can continue on with their routine eye care. Essentially, we want to really focus on the eye teaming issues, because I firmly believe that they're significant enough. I mean, I've spent a PhD and a postdoctorate and 2 years of board certification in the States, really working on this area, and there are still cases that will stump me. So I will end up dealing with these cases, and the vast majority are of a similar nature, but occasionally you get the one curveball that will kind of take you from the side. So I think being a quarterback to the routine eye doctor is very important. And I think in terms of research, I mean, we have the CITT study. We have a lot of high-level NIH-funded trials that are showing that vision therapy is valid. And I think it's important to not get distracted by trying to be everything to everybody. So we're really trying to focus in on this area.
Now, the big question, I am sure that the parents listening today, they want to ask you, when do you feel that a more detailed assessment of the visual system is required over just going and having a routine eye exam? How do the public know that one's required over the other?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. My opinion is that a routine eye examination is perfectly appropriate for a routine patient. So, if you have any issues pertaining to learning difficulties, IEPs, or concussion, or if any of this comes up when the doctor's taking the case history, it's vital that both the doctor and the parent realize that the odds of the patient having an eye teaming issue, which often leads to subsequent visual memory issues like we talked about before, are actually quite high. So the best way to look at this is via the use of standardized questionnaires, at least initially to see if there's an issue. But my opinion overall, if your child has an IEP, if they have a history of concussion, especially if they're light sensitive, they have issues with reading, they probably require a more detailed ocular motor workup. However, wherever possible, we like to get the referral from the family optometrist as they can also give some context in terms of the history. However, to be clear, we do take consults without referral, but always make a point to copy the family optometrist in on the findings. Communication is really important in these cases, as not just the school, but other allied healthcare professionals, psychology, for example, must also be made aware of any visual issues, because when they're testing for this IEP in the school system, they may be doing psychological testing, not realizing that there is an ocular problem. So if a standardized psychology test, such as a Connors rating scale or the DSM for ADHD, for example, if that shows a problem, the testing person may not realize that this person is seeing double, which can actually kind of give you a false positive, which is important to be aware of. A learning difficulty is much different in nature. It means that something's getting in the way of the learning, whereas a learning disability implies permanence. And I think it's very important to differentiate between the two. In the presence of an untreated vision issue, it is simply not possible to say what the underlying issues are unless the vision issue is treated and the patient is reassessed. So basically, we want to make sure that we're treating what we think we're treating. You know, the basic example is the IEP, is the child with an IEP within the school board. Is we want to make sure that we're actually treating a learning problem and that we're not misdiagnosing a learning problem when in fact it's a vision issue that's creating the problem. So I think we have to get one step ahead of it. But I really feel the starting point for the public is, you know, even on our website, there's questionnaires that you can fill in. They're free. You can go online, fill in the questionnaire. There's actually a temperature scale on there. It shows how high the symptoms can be. It's nice if we can get the referral from the optometrist, because then they can give us the history, the prescription, what they've been up to that point. But I would say right now, in terms of patients that we see, about 15 to 20% probably come from optometry. The rest will come from occupational therapy, PTs, teachers, and other allied healthcare professionals who are trying to find out why these patients are having visual symptoms.
Well, the show's over again. It always flies by, and we could have kept talking probably for another hour, but thank you so much for being on the show today. I learned a lot, very informative. And for folks at home, if you or someone in your family thinks that they may benefit from a rehabilitative vision therapy assessment, you can either arrange a referral from your current optometrist, as we said, or call the clinic directly at 519-265-8895. You can also visit gvtc.ca for more details. And as an aside, as the doctor said, there's two standardized questionnaires on the website, also which you can submit to the clinic directly and ask them to contact you to discuss a consultation. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed it, and I hope that you'll come back and we can continue this discussion. Thank you for listening to another edition of Ask the Experts here on 570 News.